Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today we'll hear about the inaugural Larry J. Bell Jazz Artist Award and its recipient, pianist and composer Sullivan Fortner.
Overwhelmed, surprised, shocked, kind of in disbelief.
I'll chat with Grammy Award-winning singer Peabo Bryson about his amazing 50-year career.
It's not about the music for me. It's about the fellowship. That's my ultimate goal. And before the concert, any of my concerts now are over. You're going to be, if you're there, you're going to be a part of that fellowship and a part of that extraordinary moment in this time.
And our film critic, Harlan Jacobson, wraps up the New York Film Festival.
After the hunt started at the Venice Film Festival, before making its North American debut as the opening night film at New York, it's directed by the Italian Luca Guadagnino.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. Brooklyn-based pianist Sullivan Fortner has been named the recipient of the Gilmore's inaugural 2026 Larry J. Bell Jazz Artist Award, one of the most prestigious honors in music. The award was announced at a special ceremony held at the Jerome L. Green Space in New York City. Fortner gave the audience an example of his talents on the piano in his first performance as a Bell artist. Marking the largest single gift ever dedicated solely to a jazz artist, Sullivan Fortner receives $300,000 in support of his musical and career goals over the next 4 years. The pianist delights music fans all over the world. Fortner's journey from his hometown of New Orleans and mentorship under Ellis Marsalis to his ongoing collaborations with luminaries such as Cecile McLaurin-Salvon has solidified his place as one of jazz's most vital voices. Last night's event was hosted by WBGO's New Standards host, Paul Cavalcante. Sullivan Fortner also had an on-stage conversation with SiriusXM Radio's Mark Ruffin.
How are you?
Overwhelmed, surprised, shocked, kind of in disbelief. Almost, when I got the news about it, I just kind of had it in the back of my mind and just kind of put it off. Didn't really think, you know, I kind of feel undeserving, unworthy, wow. Unworthy of it, but also very humbled.
And now, you've known for a few weeks, is that right?
I've known for a few months.
A few months, okay.
Yeah.
Where were you? How'd you find out?
I was in Atlanta. Well, I got a phone call from Chris Meese, who's out there. He's probably been probably one of my best friends for like 20 years. And he also works as my agent. He called me and he said, so when you get to Atlanta, when you land, you need to do something at 3:00. So you need to go to one of the conference rooms or like banquet rooms in the lobby of the hotel. I was like, why? He said, I can't tell you, just show up and get dressed. And I was like, dressed for what? I was like, what is this? And I saw a couple of people that I recognized and I was like, what the hell is going on in here? And then Larry Bell grabbed my hand. He was like, hey, my name is Larry Bell, and I represent the Gilmore Keyboard Foundation. I was like, uh-oh, I have to write something. That was what was going in my mind immediately. It was like, oh, God, God, God. And then you guys said that you've been nominated, and you've been awarded the Larry Bell Gilmore Artist Award. And I was like, I won something? Wow, okay.
The announcement was live-streamed at thegilmore.org, as well as by the Gilmore streaming partners, including WBGO. You can find out much more about the 2026 Larry J. Bell Jazz Artist Award at WBGO.org. He's one of the premier male vocalists in contemporary music of the last quarter century. Grammy award-winning singer-songwriter Peebo Bryson is celebrating his life and 50-year musical legacy on the Golden Touch Tour through 2026. He has a performance this Saturday, October 11th, at South Orange Performing Arts Center.
It all came so easy, all the loving you gave me, the feelings we shared. And I still can remember how you touched me so tender. It told me you cared. We had a once in a lifetime, but I just couldn't see it until it was gone. A second once in a lifetime, maybe too much to ask, but I swear from now on.
The wonderful Peebo Bryson joins us today. Peebo, great to see you.
Nice to see you. Life is good?
Life is really good. And I know it's great for you because this tour that is underway, the Golden Touch Tour, has been an important one for you. How's it going?
It's going exceptionally well. We've exceeded all our expectations in many ways. I think if you do something long enough, you kind of figure out why you do it, how you do it, and what to do that's in a different way than you did it before, for different reasons that you did it for before. For me, when I was very young, actually around the age of my son now, I was fortunate enough to be taken to a multi-artist concert that featured Sam Cooke, Jackie Wilson, the original Drifters, Little Anthony, the Imperials, you want to say Chuck Berry, or I want to say the original Impressions when Lou Rawls was in their group. I witnessed something for the first time that I'd never seen before in my life. I watched. This is the height of segregation in the South. And all these artists were suddenly there in our 5,000-seat auditorium. And I was there witnessing all of this live with my mother and my older sister. And I watched music and their performance and their requests from the audience transcend racism, politics, religion, and any other social malaise that may have been in existence in that time. And I thought that was the most powerful thing I'd ever seen. And I thought to myself, even then as a kid, what a wonderful thing to do. Why doesn't everybody do it? Why aren't there more? You know, I didn't get it. But watching those artists, Black artists on stage, make those transcendent statements by making the audience, which was demographically Black and white equally, make them fellowship together. That was, and now when every day that I go to work, I try to recreate that moment with me as the protagonist.
Hmm. What was it about Sam Cooke? I know he was definitely your favorite.
Presence and talent, and a good spiritual background, which spoke directly to my core beliefs. He transcended. He had a natural charisma and power of transcendence that you can't buy and you can't really orchestrate. It's either in you or it wasn't. Even before he was a contemporary music artist, he was a gospel artist. And when he sang, people gave their lives to God. You know, that's a pretty powerful thing. And he just spread it out farther. In other words, he went amongst the heathens. Brave in and of itself in that era of social and political unrest, shall we say. To watch all that, watch people, black and white, put all those things aside just because they ask, was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. So I try to what I do now on this tour is it's not about the music for me. It's about the fellowship. That's my ultimate goal. And before any of my concerts now are over, if you're there, you're going to be a part of that fellowship and a part of that extraordinary moment in this time.
You were blessed with this soulful voice, and your romantic duets with Celine Dion, Roberta Flack, and Regina Bell are legendary. And you became known as the King of Balladeers. You won your 2 Grammy Awards. You know, I mentioned it before we started this. My daughter is a huge Disney fan, and when I told her that I was, you know, going to be talking to Peabo Bryson, who has the themes for Beauty and the Beast in A Whole New World, she was so excited. Disney.
You know why? Because that music takes people back to their happy place.
I can show you the world, shining, shimmering, splendid. Tell me, princess, now when did you last let your heart decide? I can open your eyes, take you wonder by wonder, over, sideways, and under, on a magic carpet ride. A whole new world, a new fantastic point of view, no one to tell us no, or where or say we're only dreaming.
A whole new world, a dazzling place I never knew, but now from way up here it's crystal clear that now I'm in a whole new world with you.
I, even though we're all rusty adults now, but it does make us remember better times when we had, before we had forgotten who we are and why we're here. And I think that creates a specific kind of longing and a specific kind of respect, I think, and admiration.
Yeah, and since we're talking about this, you know, 5-decade career, it has to be so special when you think about being a part of those Disney movies that children and their parents will be talking and singing together with forever.
Which was the reason why I couldn't understand why some artists who were offered these opportunities turned them down. I'm eternally grateful to them. But they were looking at it from a demographic standpoint that didn't make sense to them business-wise. Whereas I don't frown on any opportunity. I kind of let fate do what fate does, and receive my blessings with gratitude as they come.
Fate would have it that you almost weren't here to celebrate this milestone, people.
That's entirely true. The things that have sustained me through perilous times are basically the things I said no to and the things I said yes to. No to drugs. It's just my thing, my personal opinion, my choice. I made it and kept it. A lot of people advise me not to get married to someone as young as my wife. And if I'd chosen differently, I wouldn't be here because she saved my life.
Yeah, you had a heart attack, and she was there to save you.
Oh, well, you know, it's about habits that you develop in a marriage, like we kiss each other goodnight every night. That's just something we do. And she leaned over to kiss me goodnight and realized I was not breathing. I didn't even know my wife knew CPR, but I apparently chose all the right, the right woman with all the right attributes. Because, you know, I don't know how long I had not been breathing at that particular point, but the whole episode of having the Widowmaker, which is, it feels like you're going to sleep. It doesn't hurt. There's no pain. You just feel like you're going to sleep and you don't wake up ever. Mm. So when I woke 5 days later, I realized that that whole ordeal, it took about 34 minutes. And that's a long time to not be breathing.
Oh, my goodness.
And if she had not breathed for me, then I would have no cognizant skills left at this particular point.
Oh, Bebo.
I know, right?
We're so happy that she was there.
No, right? I'm not as happy as I am when I woke up 5 days later.
Well, you know, your new album, Grace, produced by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, will be out next year, celebrating your 50 years. And of course, all your duets are incredible. But I got to take you back, though, to, you know, Tonight I Celebrate My Love with Roberta Flack. When you sing that song, what memories come flashing back to you?
How much I hated it when the first time I heard it.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was because, you know, Michael Masters is a great songwriter. We all know that. He's even a unique but great producer, but he's maybe the worst singer I've ever heard. and it's not just him. I mean, come on, we've all heard Burt Bacharach sing. Come on, seriously, let's be honest. Roberta and I were doing a song called Falling in Love for the movie, Harry Hamlin movie or something like that. And Bert kept trying to sing me the melody the way he wanted that song. And I just started laughing. And he's like, what's so funny? I said, you are. He said, what's so funny about me? I said, Bert, you're the second worst singer I've ever heard in my life. I said that to Bacharach. It got really quiet in the studio. And he hit the talk back button and said, all he wanted to know was one thing. Who's the first? I mean, you know, the ego of these guys. I mean, he didn't care that I knew he was the second worst thing on the planet. He just wanted to know who he was better than. That's the only thing that concerned him.
I love it.
So I'm in the studio with Roberta. She's Roberta Flack. She's chosen me for some unknown reason to me. I'm just happy to be there. And she loves this song. So, and she was Roberta Flack and I was not. So we did a pass on it, one pass. After the first pass, you know, you go back in, you listen, and you make adjustments if necessary. I didn't like it until I heard the first playback of us singing it. Then it was in that moment that I knew it would be something that I would be happy and thrilled to sing for the rest of my life.
A whole new world We'll be
I know, right?
I'm definitely the beast in Beauty and the Beast, so I want to
Well,
thank you
no,
for.
I'm that beast. I mean, it's like I didn't meet Celine until we were actually in the studio to sing, right? And she's kind of looking at me through this glass. It's a wooden partition with a glass window, so we could look at each other, but our voices won't bleed into my voice won't bleed into her microphone, and her voice won't bleed into mine. And I know that look. I've seen it before. She's looking at me like, "Is this guy the real deal, or is he studio manufactured? Am I going to have to dial down?" And dial out and dial back in, and how hard is this going to be? And so she's tentative when she starts out, and I look at her and I smile, and she looks at me and smiles back and sends some of her B plus stuff across the waves there, and I smile and send some of my B plus stuff back at her. She starts to almost laugh, and then she just relaxes, and a few takes later, we're done.
See
And then what
that
people
smile
don't,
did it, Timo.
apparently, what people don't know about the Disney songs is this unique caveat. That would be they don't come with any instruction from anyone. There is not one suggestion made when you're singing it, when you're recording it. Whatever you give it is what it's going to have, and whatever you don't give it is what it's not going to have. That's why everything after the original people do it, it becomes a copy.
Well, the approach worked. Peebo Bryson, it has been a pleasure to meet the treasure.
Well, you don't know the this has been an honor to chat with you. You're one of the best interviewers I've ever sat with, and you're easy to talk to, and you ask questions, and you're insightful and sensitive in a way. Ways that are respectful, yet yield what the answers you're really after, and you're not afraid of the truth, and because you're a seeker of the truth.
Thank you, sir. The 63rd New York Film Festival closed this weekend. Our film critic, Harlan Jacobson, reports on two films opening this week after taking their bow at the festival.
After the Hunt started at the Venice Film Festival, before making its North American debut as the opening night film at New York. It's directed by the Italian Luca Guadagnino, now 54, who has over the last decade or so made films in English, often with his friend Tilda Swinton, once with Timothée Chalamet in Call Me By Your Name in 2017. Here, Julia Roberts, who plays Alma, a Yale philosophy professor teaching ethics, goes head to head with her prize student Maggie, played by Ayoade Abiri, who alleges that Hank Gibson, another philosophy professor played by Andrew Garfield, sexually assaulted her after a faculty house party. How this all plays out will affect Alma. She's in it up to her neck. It's her department, her prize student. Hank is something more than a colleague, and she has tenure on the line.
So are you gonna tell me why this is not true?
Everything about this feels like a cliche. She's exploiting this shallow cultural moment.
I used to think I could rely on myself, that I could trust my instincts about people, about myself. Now, I'm not so sure.
I support whatever you choose.
A reporter approached me.
Don't tell your story to someone who just wants to turn it into something they can sell.
That's your logic? I mean, that's just so cute.
Alma is also married to Frederick, a sexless owl of a psychiatrist played by Michael Stuhlbarg, given to spouting omniscient truisms, as he did as the dad in Guadagnino's Call Me By Your Name. The incestuousness of campus life gets dog park yappy as Nora Garrett's script snakes its way through the Me Too versus Not Me argument, which is festooned with conveniently placed tawdry character flaws that the script rations out one by one to each of the players. Etta Beery plays the brilliant ethics student who happens to have plagiarized her PhD thesis, snoops through her mentor's bathroom cabinet to find some extramarital pictures. Isn't that where everybody keeps them? While Alma, the ethicist, has kept an apartment in New Haven's grittier side of town for trysts with Hank, the maybe assailant. The script propels Etta Beery's student victim forward with terrier-like determination to disrupt the ritually polite white academic culture that this film loathes for its pretentious silliness and parodies for its parties where Nietzsche and Heidegger witticisms zing around the teacups of ginseng. Etta Beery's black lesbian student grievance against the world of the white male in this film's Yale tale is an extension of sorts of her role as the itchy, anxious sous chef on the hit series The Bear. The consciously modest white-on-black end credits steal a little bit from Woody Allen, as if After the Hunt is a lost companion piece to Woody's Match Point or September. It isn't. Amazon releases this film straight from the New York Film Festival into area theaters this weekend and then on to the stream. Catherine Bigelow has made a career entering the male preserve of directing police and military thrillers. Think Blue Steel, The Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty, Strange Days, and K-19 The Widowmaker, a 2002 film with Harrison Ford about a rogue Russian nuclear sub. Call that perfect training for a House of Dynamite 23 years later, a nightmare countdown film tracking a nuclear missile launched at the U.S. from an unidentified South Asian site. The film is an editor's drum solo. Here, Australian editor Kirk Baxter, his ed creds are great. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Social Network, even Backwards in the Curious Case of Benjamin Button, stitches together a downward spiral of plot loops filmed by British war film cinematographer Barry Aykroyd, whipping through set pieces of rooms in Noah Oppenheim's script tracking the missile's progress as it zeroes in on Chicago, city of 10 million. Bigelow's great cast, Rebecca Ferguson at Intelligence, Idris Elba as the president, Tracy Letts as the trigger-ready mad general suggested by the real-life Curtis LeMay, Jared Harris as the forlorn Secretary of State, variously command the early warning room in Alaska, the Pentagon control room, the White House situation room, the State Department, FEMA, and with each rotation to a new room, Oppenheim's script moves the story down one notch towards DEFCON 1. Ultimately, in each room, the job falls away, and the character stands naked and can't say what he or she knows is about to happen. Bigelow is masterful at precision TikToks while sifting the social cues of American men and women from different circumstances and generations under pressure from common threat. The template for A House of Dynamite, filmed as an inside look at the world's worst day, could be a transcript of what was said inside JFK's situation room long ago during the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, which the 1964 film Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, by director Stanley Kubrick and writer Terry Southern, played out at least as a black comedy. Imagine that last scene of Slim Pickens as Major King Kong riding the warhead down to Earth in Dr. Strangelove, but without the comfort of that sardonic laugh. In A House of Dynamite, Bigelow lets you fill in the blanks at the end. A House of Dynamite also started at Venice, showed here at the New York Film Festival, and Netflix opens it this weekend in theaters and streaming October 24th. And I'm Harlan Jacobson for WBGO.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.